When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Kendall Dineen, and today I'm speaking with author Gretchen Felker-Martin about her new novel, Cuckoo, out this June from Tor Nightfire. Cuckoo follows seven queer kids kidnapped at the behest of their parents and sent to Camp Resolution, where a group of weird counselors led by Pastor Eddie use hard labor, cruel punishment, and bad food to transform campers into, well, something else altogether. The novel is, much like Gretchen's first novel, Manhunt, filled with suspense, scenes of violence, and radical collaboration, as well as sensuality and overwhelming tenderness that will leave you thinking about the book long after you begrudgingly put it down. Thank you so much for joining us today, Gretchen.
Thank you for inviting me, and thanks for that lovely intro.
So to kick us off, could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and the kind of fiction that you write?
Sure. I was born in rural New Hampshire in a town of 600 people where I was the only gay. So that was really fun. I think that small town and New England forest experience really informs a lot of my work. Now I write what my editor calls cocaine period Stephen King books, but for queers. the kind of stuff I love is extremity. It's perfume and wilding and, Ken Russell's The Devils, things that are maximalist and trying to translate feelings into visual signifiers that are more real than real.
Can you tell us then sort of how you came up with the idea for this novel?
Yeah, I really started writing this novel because I had all of this really uncontrollable anger about the way that queer children are being treated in America right now that I just didn't have anything productive to do with. And since walking into public areas and screaming at the top of your lungs is frowned upon, I decided to write a book. So this book is for the children whose parents see them as a problem. And for anyone who's ever been subjected to conversion therapy of any kind or to religious indoctrination that makes you hate yourself, it's just this, it's like a uniquely modern problem, right? Like you're completely overwhelmingly aware that people like you are being tortured for no reason and there's nothing you can do about it. It's intimate, but you're not connected to it. It's really fucking horrible.
As somebody who was like homeschooled in rural Idaho.
Hey, same hat.
Yeah, I can kind of relate. I guess it seems weird to say I enjoyed reading this novel because it is like talking about such horrible things, but obviously it is so enjoyable to read as well. I appreciate the sort of impulse that led to this text. So I was curious because the novel takes place in two time periods, well, 2 years. So you start in 1981 and then move into 2011. And I was curious if you could tell us a little bit about why you kind of picked those years.
Well, those are periods in time that I'm very aesthetically familiar with. I grew up in the 90s. I became an adult in the 2010s. So those are really resonant touchstones in my own lives, my own life. And I'm fudged dates around a little bit. I probably can't tell you why at this point. A lot of stuff that seems so pressing and obvious when you're working on a project just sort of bleeds away over time. But broadly, it's just that they resonate with me. I know what those times look and feel like. I know what movies people were watching. I know what public spaces were like. This is Lenny, by the way. Familiarity more than anything.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, so camp resolution. It seems like it's obviously like a commentary on conversion camps, like you mentioned, but it also reminds me of like FAT camps and also like camps for delinquent children, quote unquote. Yeah. And so I was wondering if you could kind of talk through those connections.
I mean, all of those institutions presuppose that if there's something you don't like about your child, you should be able to pay a violent stranger to fix it. It presupposes that misery and enforced discipline and really things that if they were done to an adult, we would immediately understand as torture are the way to fix your child. And we believe this in the face of all evidence. We know they don't work, but it doesn't matter because I think the actual impulse they channel is to hurt your child. I think that America is a country where it's become very normal to despise your own children and to want them punished and sometimes even killed. I mean, we're watching it play out right now all across college campuses across the country. You see people who certainly have college-age children screaming in national publications that we should be going in there and cracking heads with the National Guard. It's deranged. And America, of course, is a gerontocracy. Our presidents are getting older and older and more decrepit. Our government is getting older and older and more decrepit. And these people are so afraid, not just of their own irrelevance, but of being asked to face the end result of their lifetimes of decision making that have led to unimaginable bloodshed and suffering and privation for no real gain aside from, I guess, lining corporate pockets, that they're just lashing out violently in every direction.
Yeah, I have been thinking about that, watching what's going on these campuses as like the disdain for young people. It's just, it slaps you in the face. It's totally unignorable.
I think there's a huge feeling of effrontery that comes when someone says something so obviously right, and you have to confront that you've seen the same thing and chosen to make the wrong choice. And then someone comes along and is like, well, fuck you, you're a genocidal maniac. And you're like, how dare you make me feel bad?
That is really the
Don't you know
feeling,
that my
right?
complicity in international crime pays for your designer shoes or whatever? Some bullshit elite logic. It's sad. It's really sad. I think that generationally we're so alienated from each other.
Yeah, I agree. So I wanted to ask you about, speaking of fat camps, one of my favorite things about your work, something that makes it like so cathartic for me to read, is the way that you incorporate fatness. Because I like research fatness in American fiction. It's very different what you're doing, right?
Thank you.
From sort of the norm. So if you could talk a little bit about like, how are you using fatness and fat characters and sort of why, I guess.
Mostly, it's out of my own desire to see those things in fiction, to see myself reflected in fiction as a fat woman, and to see experiences that resonate with me. I feel like so many people with normative bodies take so much for granted about the experience of engaging with fiction because it reflects them faultlessly. And I'm certainly capable of stretching outside my own experience of the world in order to enjoy great work. I'm not a mobster from New Jersey. I'm not a vampire, but I still love The Sopranos and Carmilla. But to my mind, it's this huge blind spot. Like, where is it? If the best we have is like Stephen King in 800 books having a panic attack about finding fat women sexy, that's not great, man. It's kind of fucking boring. And so I wanted to do something that felt like really personal and intimate to me. I wanted to depict my own life on the page, like my life in which I am a fat queer woman who has sex with other fat queer women and like loves and values fat bodies. Like, you know, to me, obviously it's an inherently political thing to write about, but it's very personal too. It feels really close to home and not like something I have to force, you know, like I'm not sitting down and thinking like, here's how I'm going to portray fatness to win the culture war. It's just like, fuck you. I'm gonna have fat sex on this page and you have to read it. And if you don't like it, you can screw.
Personally, I do like it.
Thank you. I do too, obviously.
Okay. So we kind of touched on this, I think, or maybe touched on part of your answer, but I was struck by, you know, the first section of the book, the characters, they're all teenagers, right? And you sort of are, the novel is very like insistent that on reminding us that the things that are happening to kids, and the characters who are trying to figure out how to navigate these things are kids. And you know, obviously they sort of have to be kids in a way, because only kids could be vulnerable to this kind of environment, the situation that they're placed in. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, I don't know if that was like an intentional decision to keep reminding the reader, or like why it's important to you, if it is that we're keeping this in mind, right? That it's at the forefront of our mind as we're reading.
To me, it's very important and it's very central to the book because, like you said, this could only happen to children. Adults, it's almost impossible to imagine them being put in this situation outside of like a cult. But it's normal for us to give our children to cults of all kinds. And I think, you know, my experience of childhood was very powerless and frightened and dangerous. And it was liberating to me to encounter books that acknowledged that were like, yeah, the dynamic between children and adults is inherently unfair and exploitable by parents, in all kinds of ways, emotionally and physically. And I want to do that for kids who pick up my books. You know, I would like them to feel understood and listened to and seen as human beings.
So, kind of continuing with this, can you talk about writing teenagers who are like figuring out their gender, their sexual desires, and are sort of like exploring these and coming to these ideas like with and through one another?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is always like the eternal ridiculous contradiction at the heart of gay conversion therapy. If you put a bunch of gay teenagers together, what do you think is going to happen? Which, you know, again, it comes back to the fact that they know it doesn't work. They're just trying to hurt them. Mostly I just drew on my own experiences. You know, like I said, it was a chaotic, difficult time in my life, and I went through a lot of weird phases and made a lot of false assumptions about myself and got hurt and ran around like an idiot with all the wrong people. You know, like it's an exciting, devastating time to be a human being a teenager. And I wanted to pay my respect to that because I think that teenagers go through so much and they don't get a lot of credit for it. It's rough to just like have hormonal psychosis for 8 years.
I think that definitely comes through in reading, like the incredible things that some of these kids do and like relationships that they form with one another and with themselves. Like, I think there's a lot of, I don't know, care and like respect there that's very evident on the page. Yeah, it's just
Thank
really
you.
lovely to read. So kind of like shifting now, I noticed that in Cuckoo, like in Manhunt, you're sort of the narration is like frequently shifting from the perspective of one character to another, which I personally really like. But I was wondering if you could talk about like, why do you use this narrative technique?
Structurally, most of my familiarity with narrative is through film and television. And film and television is, of course, not bound by perspective in the same way that like limited perspective third person is. So to me, it enables me to keep the characters cleanly separated from each other. It enables me to do things that I enjoy with pacing. And it also helps me focus. Like if I can keep moving from character to character, I can get a better sense of momentum. as well as, you step away from things that start to feel tired and go explore something else. And I'm writing a book with one character right now, and it's been a challenge. I've really enjoyed it, but definitely a very, very different vibe.
Well, I look forward to reading it.
Okay, I hope you like it.
Yeah, I'm sure I will. Okay, so you had talked earlier about like kind of liking enjoying like the excesses, right? The excessive. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about your use of like gore and violence and sort of grotesquery, because you certainly get it in Manhunt, but like there were scenes in Cuckoo that I was reading where I was like, this is crazy. This is so like the thing being described is so disgusting. Like it's just wonderful, you know?
Thank
So I would just
you.
love to hear you talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is like my really deep emotional relationship to the work of David Cronenberg. Some of it is my lifelong love affair with the practical effects from The Thing. But emotionally, I think what animates it is that when you're queer, when you're mentally ill, when you're fat, when you're disabled, you spend all this time in really intense, forced intimacy with your own body. You're trapped inside this thing that the people around you hate and want gone and wish was different. And you start to internalize those feelings, and then you can't get away from them because they are about the meat that is you. And the idea of all of that changing all of a sudden becomes so cathartic and exciting. And so explosive violence and body horror and transformation, those things become almost sexual. It becomes orgasmic to imagine like the flesh of your body opening up and tearing apart.
Yeah, thank you. I could totally relate to that.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay. So another thing that I really enjoy about your work is that, there's all of these, there's always all this fucked up stuff going on, right? But in the midst of that, you get these like these characters who are using these horrible, violent, hostile surroundings as sites for like a real collaboration that is like messy and full of friction, but also like tender and really interesting. I feel like you don't like romanticize or idealize like people's resistance that they really have no choice whether to resist or not, right? It's like resist or die. And so I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about like how you are writing collaboration and resistance and like what purpose this serves in your fiction, but also like maybe like for yourself as a person, as an author, et cetera.
I mean, it comes from my politics. I'm a longtime, very hardline leftist. I'm somewhere between anarchism and communism. And I, when people say in community or whatever, I take that very seriously. I have a community. Those are the people that I see every day, that I support and who support me, that I, give money to help out with living expenses, or that I count on for Skillshare, like people that I am on deck to pick up from protests, arrests, and stuff. Like, they're part of my life. And not every one of those people is like my good friend or even necessarily someone I want to hang out with, but they're still my community. They're here, they're doing things that I agree with that makes them my community. Like, solidarity is a big, big word to me. It's not about being right and being the last leftist standing in the circular firing squad. It's about literally standing together, whether that's between a cop and someone they're trying to arrest, or between the people in your community and starvation. Like, these are serious, immediate, extremely ethically pressing questions. And to me, it's one of the most worthwhile things to make art about, because were really discouraged from talking about it. The idea of feeding someone else, of housing someone else, clothing someone else, of making yourself responsible for their safety is so anathema to American culture. You know, we're trained to see it as deranged.
Well, thank you so much for being here, sharing your time with me, and for your wonderful books. I love them so much. Before I let you go, I wanted to ask, I mean, you did mention this, you're working on your novel with one character. Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners about? Or I don't know if there's some place that you would like to promote where they can find your work and you.
You can find me on Blue Sky. I have an updates only account on Twitter. I'm Scumbelievable in both places. I also have a Patreon under my own name. My novel Cuckoo comes out on the 11th, and early next year, I'm going to be releasing Black Flame, which is about a repressed Jewish lesbian working at a conservative film restoration center, who comes into possession of this like pornographic black magic cabaret video from Weimar, Germany, and is tasked with restoring it. And the deeper she gets into the project, the more she begins to suspect that the acts of deranged, outlandish violence depicted in it are in fact real.
That sounds awesome.
Thank you. I'm so glad that you found something in my work.
I definitely did. All right. Well, thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it. And
thank you for having me.
Of course.